Outrider Podcast.
Okay, so here we are. Welcome to the laboratory, number 3, part of the Outrider podcast with my cohort, my co-conspirator, Stephen McClurg. And we're going to jump right in. We struggled with this exercise, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
I think I struggled worse than you did because I have, I have a paragraph and a sentence, or two sentences.
Well, I think we even said, I mean, that's closer, I think, to what we initially said, how long it was supposed to be, right?
Right.
I've got this 2,100 long story that I still have like 3 scenes to write.
And, right.
Yeah, it was really hard to get started on this one. I was just trying to look back and see where what the rules were initially.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, here they are.
Take a violent event from your life, write it in the first person, shift it to the other person in the story, and then tell it from the other character's point of view. Those last 3, those were the original ones I wrote down, but I think we tweaked it again or something like that.
The other ones I have, it's basically that. Use a violent event from your life, writing about the event in the first person, rewrite it in third, or maybe that's the tweaking of it, and then rewrite it again from the other person's POV.
Right.
It seems like that is really meant to be a kind of exercise in perspective.
Uh-huh.
And, I didn't do that at all.
Right, right.
And it took weeks before I had even the kernel of an idea. I don't know why, but... I mean, what I ended up doing, I'm okay with, and we may do some comics with the character I came up with and stuff. So,
mm-hmm. I'm going to take a look here. I wrote my stuff on the 27th of. Is that right? That's not right. No, yeah. Would have been just after. I was off to a fiery start with my paragraph and 2 sentences on the 27th of April.
Of April? Then, oh, wow. Wow, yeah, you started way earlier than me.
And, then it basically I went through all of May, because it is the last day of May, isn't it?
Yep.
And didn't do squat. And I guess that kind of touches on some of the other stuff. The topics we kind of were shooting back and forth
around,
in the emails, that, do you want to share part of what you came up with? Not the whole thing. Cause mine's like, if I share any of mine, it's going to be incredibly short.
I can. Yeah. Let me, again, I'm, we learning, you can do multiple things on the screen at once. No, I'm not a tech person.
That's cool.
Was there any, did you get a chance to look over it at all?
No, let me tell you how crappy my May went.
I'm right with you.
I found it a lot easier to binge watch, shows on Netflix than even get out and exercise and run this last month. Of course, there was all the rain, so there was always some kind of excuse. And then, muscle spasms. And I think, just sit on my ass.
Yeah, I had the end of school, so I had to do a lot of stuff there. And between that and then it really took me 2 or 3 weeks to come up with an idea. Do you want me to talk about that process?
Sure. Yeah.
It was, the image, I couldn't do it for my own life,
mm-hmm.
only because really like what that would come down to is like my dad's suicide. And
right.
I've written about that before in other forums. And I just like, especially writing from his perspective, just didn't seem like something I wanted to do.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? And so I was like, well, I'll just do, you know, like I do with any kind of prompt I get. I'm like, I'm just going to do what I want to anyway with the, you know, the prompt. Like, as long as the prompt inspires you
right
to do something, then it's fulfilled what a prompt should do.
Right.
It's rare. Like the last one I actually was able to, you know, that we did, I was actually with the cut ups able to follow the procedure. Most of the time I don't. And that's kind of my relationship to writing prompts. I wrote a poem about those, how much I, you know, the love and hate about them.
Right.
So the image that kept coming back to me was, and I think I've talked about this before, how I generally start with images. Like it's just the way I think about things. And the image was from a book I read about 10 years ago called I'd Rather Be the Devil, Skip James and the Blues.
Oh, wow.
It's by Stephen Colt. I like it a lot. There was an article, I think, in the Oxford American where another big musicologist was, you know, I think the article, I have it somewhere online. It's called Not My Skip James or something like that. What I liked about that book in particular was there wasn't a lot of hero worship. It was really, it felt like a presentation of like a real human being with all his flaws.
Right.
And Skip James is, what would I guess call it? He did city and country blues and the difference between that, which if you really study, it doesn't really hold up. But the basic way of people talk about that is at that time, country blues was played on a guitar, city blues was played on a piano, and he was one of the few who crossed over and did both. But I really like his songs a lot. He is one of my favorite kind of, you know, old blues players. You know, I mean, it's hard to get in, you know, it's like anything, like a genre or something like that. You know, there are going to be certain people that kind of affect you a certain way. And I like the style of that music, but I'm not one of those people who like got really serious into it, like R. Crumb or something. But Skip James happened to be one that I liked a lot. Mm-hmm. And so I read this book came out, and I had found it in a used bookstore, and I read it, and I liked that he was presented as a human being with all his flaws.
Right.
And one of those flaws was they would have, he owned a house where they would do house frolics. And so these were parties where they'd have moonshine. They would have food, like catfish and stuff like that. And he would play music and people would come in and dance and pay a certain amount of money and eat and dance and, you know, just party.
Right.
It was usually in places where they didn't have like a legal juke or they're called barrel houses also. Right. One of the things that people would do is thieves would come in and they would either cut or knock over or turn out. There was usually like a kerosene lamp or something in there for lighting. It was usually fairly dark.
Right.
And a lot of times there would be like a money jar for the house and for the band or for the, usually the guy playing music. Well, thieves would come in and they would knock out the lights and grab the money jar and run. The image from the book that got me was that Skip James, more than once in his own houses, would just level a gun or a shotgun on the dance floor and just fire away. And so they really don't know like how many people he may have killed.
Wow.
Yes. And so that was the image of violence that, It's stuck with me from reading.
So he would have the shotgun on the piano or whatever, and if someone knocked out the light, he'd just start shooting.
Yeah. If he thought something was going to happen or whatever, he would shoot on. There's at least one and probably more at least according to this biography, you know, cases of him doing that.
Wow.
Because no one cared about, you know, it was just like, oh, it's, you know, house party. In their idea of it was, you know, a bunch of dead black people. They'll take care of it or whatever. And,
right.
You know, it didn't matter. So, like, he was never.
Wow.
Yeah. So that image to me was something that had always stuck with me. And what that. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. You knew it was coming.
Hey.
Yeah. I know. Sometimes we fall. But you got back up again, and that's all that matters. Yeah, we're going sans clothes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Snowmen make us happier, evidently. All right. Sorry.
That's all right.
Yeah. they haven't made it to the park yet.
That's all right. That's what happens with family, you know? Hey.
That's again, too, like that. Now imagine you're writing, you're trying to, like, sit in here and write, and that's, you know, so... Not as an excuse, but that's part of the reason why I just didn't finish the story. So that stuck with me, and so I went back and went through that book, and oddly at the same time, I was reading some Hellboy comics, and there was a whole introduction in one of the. It's I think the book was The Crooked Man and Other Stories.
Uh-huh.
And the story with the Crooked Man actually has, it's basically a Silver John or John the Balladeer story. And he was a character created by Manly Wade Wellman, who was a pulp writer back with.
Yep. I'm
Weird
familiar with him. A friend of mine here in town is a big Manly Wade Wellman.
This led me that the Hellboy story, which was borrowed one of his characters, led me to the Manly Wade Wellman stories. Mm-hmm. And I only read a couple about this character who was a guitarist, and he's like a basically kind of like Hellboy. He's like a cryptozoological detective, or like John or Constantine or something. I don't know if you're familiar with that character, but
That was so the one they made. That was the one they made into a movie with Keanu.
Yes, yes. And, yeah. I've heard the Constantine. I believe started in the Swamp Thing comics by Alan Moore, which are great. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're really good. And he's trying to teach Swamp Thing like what he is at one point in the stories and about like larger conspiracies and all this, but. Anyway, right. The same kind of character. So I read a few of the Manly Wade Wellman stories, and you know, it's what you would. I like them a lot. It's what you would expect. Kind of, he was more from. It's like more about hill country,
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing, and witchcraft and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And so. I had those things, but then what I wanted to do is, because it was Skip James, I wanted to make like an Alabama Mississippi Delta version of that character.
Right.
And so that was where Nehemiah was Skip James' real name. So I made up the character Nehemiah Temple, who is, I kind of fashioned in the same way. It's like this, you know, conjure man who, uh-huh. because, and so, what that led me to is, you know, the 19th century was one of my areas of study,
right.
in English. And so I've always liked that era, even though the music, the crossover there really isn't quite right, but whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, alternate universe or whatever. I set him on... where I lived from the ages of about 11 to 18, and that was Dauphin Island. And it's a barrier island in the Gulf Coast. Originally called Massacre Island, so I got to use that in the story. Because when the French, and so this is what led me, so then I started, like, what happened was I went into a research rabbit hole.
Right.
You know, I went into the research thing, and so where I grew up was in 1699, the French got there, and there were bones, human bones everywhere, and they called it Massacre Island. It eventually became Dauphin Island. But, because they thought it was like, you know, this is a crazy whatever, you know,
right,
occult place and all this, savages and whatnot. But really, like, what probably happened was a storm or hurricane hit, like, the burial area, area and scattered those remains over the island. And there were shell mounds and there were all this other stuff there. So I was able to use all that in the story. So instead of being like hill country, this is like a Gulf Coast, you know,
swamp
conjurant man detective, you know, he, and what's cool is Dauphin Island, the history of it too. I didn't really go into this in the story, just, you know, just more about the name and everything, but it had connections to like Haiti, Cuba and Africa and stuff.
Oh, wow. Right.
So like the backstory I was able to hint at was like, you know, he's been to Haiti and studied, you know, voodoo there. He's gone to Africa. He's done all these things, and now he lives on this island. He used to be a popular musician,
right,
and now he's kind of, you know, does this cryptozoological detective stuff. So I don't know. That was kind of like how the character developed eventually. Right.
Well, this sounds like it's bigger than just a short little exercise. It sounds like you need to run with this for a while.
Well, that's Derek. You know, Derek's pretty picky about like what he's going to want to do for, you know, his comic output. And I mean, I understand it takes a lot of time to do what he does. If he likes it, we may, you know, start doing some comic stories. And
oh, cool.
To me, where that leads me is into, I have one really large idea that I would like to do at some point. I'd put it on a blog post where it's basically my version of like, I think it really all goes back to, what is it? The most dangerous game, or what is that short story?
That's the one where the people are kidnapped and put on an island and hunted.
I think it's called Most Dangerous Game or something like that. But basically, like, to me, that's like Duel, Predator, Jaws. Like, these are all some of my favorite movies, but they're all kind of variations of that idea. And so I have a 19th century version of that I want to do. But also, I mean, you know, Bram Stoker and Walt Whitman were trading letters and I think may have even met. I mean, Walt Whitman and vampires sounds like fun to me. I don't know. It may just be like, I may have created like a person, a kind of area where I can just have that output of like all the kind of genre stuff that I really like.
Right.
That's fun to me. so that may, you know, come into it. Uh-oh. The monkeys escaped. Yes, big kisses. Yeah. Okay. So that's what ended up happening with the story. That has nothing to do with the rules we set up for the prompt at all. but it was fun to work on. And the other challenge of it is, like I had kind of said to you in one of the emails, is for me, I find straight storytelling fiction, straight ahead fiction, very difficult to do. And I feel like it's one of my
do you mean straight ahead storytelling that falls into Freytag's, you know, P pyramid, you know, for a...
Well, I mean, or even if it doesn't do that, like, the element of, like, something that's not a poem and something that's not a script,
mm-hmm.
something that falls in the middle, like I said, without a gimmick, the way that I have always kind of approached. And gimmick's probably a wrong word.
One of the things I always used to say, you know, at least back in graduate school years ago, was that if I had a hard time, you know, doing something normally, I would trick myself and back into it. And that sounds like what you're doing is that in order to get to this story in your head, you've got to, there's some kind of block. And so you're tricking yourself, and that's not a gimmick. That's a legitimate form of self-delusion. You know,
I think it is. I just also want to be able to do the other thing as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm pretty good at coming up with, you know, okay, here's a bizarre, these are a group of dictionary entries, and I can tell my story through these bizarre dictionary entries, and I'll do the sound out of the words, and I'll do all, you know, syllable structure and all that. And I don't mind writing a fake history for all these words and then tying that into some narrative I have in my head. Like, that kind of writing is almost, that's the natural way that I approach things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if that makes sense. You know what I mean? Like, I'm always, there's always like a, in other words, I'm always embedding, it's easy for me to embed a narrative and not tell the narrative.
Right.
But tell it in pieces while I'm also like telling jokes and doing all this other stuff.
Right.
Which I guess falls under that kind of postmodern,
mm-hmm.
maybe, you know, style. And what's weird is I haven't read a lot of that stuff. Because I had written, really mostly poetry was always comfortable, but then writing comics and film stuff for visuals,
mm-hmm.
I always, the thing is, I just, for me, I feel like I don't have those muscles, you know, I'm flexing those, I'm learning those muscles, like of just like telling a story, like not embedding the narrative cryptically in, like I told you about that one story where it's a psychologist's notebook.
Right.
And, you know, the story is told there, but there's also like, oh, yeah, there's a dinner meeting, and, you know, that, you know, you know, that lamb kebab over there is really good. You know, like embedding these kind of things in avoiding telling a story.
Right.
Does that make sense to you? Because, I mean, you're very good at, I mean, you do the other, for me, you do the other thing. Like, you can tell a narrative and write a story. And that's, for me, that is, I find it very difficult.
Yeah. I
I'm not, I mean, does it make sense how I'm, what I'm, you know?
Well, yeah, it does. And
I feel like I'm blabbering on.
Well, for me, you know, this is kind of where it gets into, I feel like what little bit of study I've done into structuralism, which consists mostly of Gerard Genet.
Are you reading by him, by the way?
Oh, I
need to read. I love that stuff because mm-hmm. because it comes down to like diagrams and forms and like all these. I just love that whole.
I'm not sure who does the diagrams and stuff like that for structuralism. Genet doesn't. This book. His primary one, the book that kind of got it all started, was Narrative Discourse.
Right, yeah.
Which I'm rereading because...
Did you read it at grad school?
Or? Yeah. It was the kind of the technical basis for my master's thesis. Because the thing that's...
Cool. I love all that stuff. I mean, I haven't read that in particular.
Right.
I know of him, but I haven't read it. But like, I really enjoy reading that stuff.
Yeah, I need to branch out more into some of the other people that were that followed him and did some, you know, contemporary work with him. You know, and I'm always a little bit tentative about claiming what my stories mean. You know, what did you mean when you did this? What did you mean?
Oh, sure.
Finding where, and to me, you know,
I'm just referring to like structurally, like how,
right.
How it's written or.
Right.
Something.
Right. Because when I first started out writing, when I first was, you know, in undergrad stuff and before I read Janae in graduate school, I was always a very strictly linear writer. Mm-hmm. You know, the structure of the story, the form of the story, I was almost bound to Freytag's pyramid. You know, you have the start off here and you rise, action gets up, you have your climax, and then you do your thing and your denouement, and blah 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 blah, and you get out the door.
When did you start in that mode, or was it just automatic for you from reading?
It was just automatic from reading. That was how stories were presented. When you read genre fiction, that's kind of how everything is built.
Yeah. I find it really hard to do, though. Well, I don't know if maybe because I read too much other stuff before I really, like I said, my first fiction writing that I attempted to do, massive failures, and mm-hmm. what I found is I could.
Well, mine were too. You know, that's part of the problem. But yeah, when you
but
grow
I think
up,
I ran from it. I think you embraced it and were able to conquer it in a way, and you can do it. I ran away and started doing these alternate mm-hmm. ways of organizing, but it was really a way of disguising the fact that I couldn't write a straight narrative. In terms of fiction, a short mm-hmm. story or like novel kind of things.
Right.
So I admire that ability. So you started that way.
Mm-hmm.
And you said did you did you feel like confident about the structure from the beginning?
No. The stories happened in a linear fashion because you start at the beginning or you start in media res, you know, near the point of conflict or whatever, and then you tell it through to the end because that's the way, you know, horror books were written. That's the way science fiction books were written. There's not a lot of there wasn't a lot of interest or obsession with the impact or effect of memory. There wasn't, and a lot of the stuff I started reading when I was young, you know, and of course we've talked about this before. I was until I got to college, I was taught literary fiction badly.
Yeah, you didn't have a good, you know, I mean, I didn't have a good, particularly good high school.
And so, yeah, when you're battling that part and you're also you know, being taught literary fiction badly means that you assume that there's only one way that a story has meaning and you can either interpret it correctly or incorrectly. Right. And so you drop yourself into writing fiction with that same type of mentality.
Mm.
And on top of that, you aren't, for one reason or another, your form is rigid and set, which is what that whole Freytag's pyramid thing does when you've only been reading that and being forced to interpret stories that way with that form, and also interpreting them with one, you know, thematic conclusion.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
You're right. Then you find yourself sitting there going, what does it mean? How do I get meaning into the story? What do I have to say? And it wasn't until a combination of things, structuralism, for one, and also, you know, as an undergrad, being, you know, finally informed that, you know, a story can mean whatever you want it to mean as long as you can support that meaning with evidence, with some way of backing it up.
I talk to students about that, and I go all the way back to Aristotle, mm-hmm. and the rhetorical triangle, And when you look at the rhetorical triangle, the reader is a third of that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the reader makes meaning, you know, I mean, there's
correct,
you know, I mean, and like you said, if there's evidence for it, then, you know, it seems like, you know, good reading or a plausible reading.
Right. So I had, that was my first revelation, was that my stories have a certain meaning for me, but they're going to have wildly different meanings for other people. So, you know, I just need to write the story that I want to write. I need to ask. That was when I began to realize, no, you have to start, your story has to be about asking questions and not about coming up with answers.
Mm. That's right. That's a nugget. Yeah.
Right. But what I didn't have was a way to, for my own psychology, for my own, the way my own brain works, is a way of manipulating the story to get to those questions. Hmm. And, you know, I struggled a lot. A lot of my stories didn't work before graduate school because I was having this linear thing. And how do you get, when you're only looking in one direction, how do you get to all of that stuff inside a person's, you know, psyche that informs that decision they make at that moment? Right. And
what was your writing? Did you do any, like, I started, even goes back to sixth grade where mm-hmm. I got censored for writing movie reviews or films.
Like, when I got started, it was always
or anything like,
I didn't start journaling till high school. And
journalism, did you write like nonfiction prose, like, or did you write work for any, did you write for any like newspaper? I wrote for the alternative newspaper and stuff. Right.
Well,
and I had this whole background of journalism that helped
me sorry.
Much later. No, it's but, you know, that was it. So I felt like I got a good idea of like a cleanness.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you had all these certain rules that you had to do even for like reviews. And
yeah, that was my other crippling thing was the high school journalism. You know, like I said, I started writing short stories in the sixth grade.
Wow.
And well, before that, I'd just been telling stories, you know,
telling.
usually to
called lying.
Yeah. You know, the pet tiger and the little brother and all this other stuff. You know, but yeah. And then everything was always, you know, just this attempt to be linear, attempt to, and then journalism came in and reinforced the whole thing, you know? But, when I picked up, Genet in graduate school, you know, the narrative discourse, there was, it was simultaneously with picking up on Dace, who, you know, started off as a poet, who kind of approaches fiction the way you do. You slide up to it, you sneak around behind it. And what
is that how Genet talks about it?
No. but you know, it's what it did was that structuralism, the whole point behind structuralism is that the meaning of the story to their approach is irrelevant. And it's not because there isn't meaning. It's because it doesn't matter. What they're concerned with is the mechanics of pointing the reader towards meaning.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, this scene means something, but how do you get the reader to this, you know, this image, this scene, this path, this moment has some kind of meaning or relevance to that character? How do
it's like figuring out a blueprint.
Right. How do you build the story? How do you structure the scene how do you focalize the information? Who's filtering the information? What's the duration? What's the, you know, has to do with, you know, time and duration and all this other stuff. That's why I'm going back and rereading it, because the terminology, I had it down pat when I wrote the thesis, and then I wandered off into the rest of the world. You know, and that's where I started really getting a handle on on being able to get to the kind of stories I wanted to tell and the way that I wanted to tell them. And it freed me up. It got me away from that need to tell something in a linear fashion, so that I could just drop everything in the middle of a scene, you know, in the middle of a present time, you know, forward moving scene, drop everything and just backpedal into the past, into do whatever. I could start in the past. I could, you know, I could make those connections.
Like, he uses Proust a lot in that book.
Yeah. Well,
right?
that whole thing about narrative discourse was that he was using Proust as the source material.
Oh, okay. So kind of like Aristotle using Sophocles. Okay, cool. Man.
So
I'm really enjoying this. Who are those hardcore, like, narratology?
Right.
People who are going to listen. But I mean, it almost doesn't matter, but I'm, I don't get these, you know, I don't get to have these talks.
Yeah, neither do I very often. I mean,
so it's,
you know,
I find it very, I look forward to it. So
cool.
I mean, hopefully someone else does. But
yeah, but that's, you know, the, it's Gerard Genet and structuralism. And part of the reason I need to finally get off my ass 10 years after my MFA and actually read more, you know, Barthes and other people were part
Barthes
of,
great. Have you read the Mythologies book?
No.
It's great. It's fun. It's absolutely fun. He does like a whole kind of like symbolist reading of a wrestling match. He does. I think that's the one that has the essay. Rita Hayworth's Face, I think, is what it's called.
Right.
Stuff like that. Like it's fun. Really, really fun.
So yeah, So who's the other guy? Roland Barthes and, I don't know how to pronounce this guy's first name. Tsetan, Todorov, T-O-D-O-R-O.
Oh, okay.
Those are the two guys I need to add up to.
Wasn't there a lot of Russians who did a lot of structural stuff?
Yeah.
Narratology, Bakhtin, or I mean, I don't know how to say his name, but
Yeah, there's a whole
school of Russian folks.
Right. And then I figure I need to add in the post-structuralist just to.
Oh, yeah. Well, Bart, you know, he's a pivot point. You know, he started as a structuralist, I believe, and pivoted into post-structuralism.
Right.
He's one of those pivots.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that stuff. I've always enjoyed it. A part of that, I think, was just my philosophy background. Like, so many of those guys had their background in philosophy, so it was. I always had fun reading them, and I think a lot of English majors didn't.
Yeah, I don't understand that, but oh well. But no, Genet paired really well with, you know, because Genet being part of the structuralist and not really focusing on meaning paired really well with John Gardner. And
oh, wow.
Particularly, you know, on moral fiction and things like that, where he discusses that the whole point behind fiction has a certain moral level and a certain moral significance.
It's a good book. I didn't read that until recently. And then I just read his other book on writing fiction or something like that.
Yeah. The Art of Fiction. And
there's
also his book On Becoming a Novelist, which I was useful.
I haven't read that one. Is it good? Have you read that one?
Yeah, yeah.
His, like, even if I agree, like, I noticed, especially in, I think it is The Art of Fiction, like, there were things that I just didn't agree with him on. I still enjoyed the book. Like, it was like, this is good stuff. I on moral fiction, I know I really enjoyed a lot. Like, there were certain things that I just... really liked in that book.
Right.
I should have taken more notes because I can't speak of any of those.
Well, you know,
I enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah. The dangerous thing with structuralism is that it, and, you know, I think Gardner might agree with us on this, is that pure structuralism does kind of open the door for meaningless
fiction. You don't want to be a formula.
Right. Because
you don't want to plug things in any of those movements, you know, it's the same with literary criticism, is that it can become a formula. Like,
right.
Stanislaw Lem has a story about this. And it's like about a machine. It's like, you know, you put a text into the machine and kind of like turn the machine on, and then it will give you the meaning. And then you put that and what it ends up is, like, I think in the story, then they put that meaning back into the machine and it becomes this weird loop of things. But like, you don't want to just be like the deconstructionist machine, the psychoanalytic machine, the feminist machine, because it can make things formulaic, which really where I've seen that the most is like in either bad feminist criticism or bad psychoanalytic criticism.
Right.
Where
they forget that sometimes a cigar is just a cigar.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. post-Freud. Freud's literary criticism is great. And a lot of fun. Some of the people after him, I just don't think were interesting thinkers or something. You know, they lost something and just.
Well, they've become a little bit dogmatic and pedantic.
It's breaking it through a machine.
Right.
Like we said, like that's one of the things with, you know.
Right.
That's where I find like the structure and the diagrams and all that stuff really, really useful. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I like to know that stuff.
Right.
But then when I'm doing something, not necessarily think about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's just it. I mean, I don't. All right, come
here. Can you say that to Jason?
This wonderful. And Mama wants her tail.
Can you say it louder?
Mama wants her tail, so I wonder.
Say the first part louder. What were you saying? There's what on the floor?
There's a poop.
There's a poop on the floor.
There's a poop on the floor. Whose poop is on the floor?
Clara.
Clara. Poop is on the floor. This is always like,
well, that's not good.
Like
it's about to storm, and so I can't take them to the
Roland Barthes, Stanislaw Lem,
and poop on the floor.
This is the balance in my life.
Exactly. You need that.
Always willing.
Girls.
Always willing to bring it down to bring it to a different level. I'll say that. Maybe not down, but to a different level.
You've always got to be grounded. There's always got to be something to ground you, and nothing grounds you quite like poop on the floor. That is, pardon the pun, some real world shit. Yeah.
There you go. You're a camera hog. Come on now. Go help Mama. Okay. Thank you.
I can't see you, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. You have that turned off?
No, I've got it on. I don't, or maybe I.
Oh, do I have it turned off? See, I thought you were getting the whole. Man, I'm so bad with this stuff.
There we are.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I thought you were getting the whole like.
No, I was.
Her telling you there's just on the floor. Yeah. Sorry. What are you doing?
But yeah, no, the melding of Genet and Gardner, trusting that if you ask the right questions, if you are going in there to consciously ask a moral question about something, and then with structuralism, I'm able to not limit myself to that linear way of telling a story. I can just backpedal, backtrack. I can turn the focus. I can switch to a different character or something like that to, I can play with time even, and to draw attention to the question that I want to ask about, you know, that moral moment, then that when someone decides to do something bad or something good.
I think those are all subtleties of mm-hmm. still telling that linear narrative. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, it's like you could basically like unfold that and you could still have that linear narrative. Does that make sense?
Right.
And I think there's subtlety to that kind of writing when it's done well, that's the thing that I think I find difficult about it. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm always kind of awed by it when someone can, you know, do it and pull it off. You know what I mean? Because it just doesn't come natural to me. I don't like. I always have to make up something. Yeah, right. I mean, generally, I'm putting like.
I think you might get some use out of narrative discourse then.
Yeah, no, I've this writing this story this time. I mean, I've done a lot of, you know, since I guess 2011, 2012, I've done a lot of narrative work and analyzed a lot of narrative work. Not that I have written it, but it's been, like you said, for comics and for other stuff.
Right.
But that amount of work, thinking about that stuff, really helped. Like, I immediately was able to, like, plot out. I at least had an outline for this story almost immediately after I did the research and had the kind of a few core images that stuck in my mind. You know, my own version of Silver John, you know, Skip James, these particular images, Dauphin Island, where I grew up, sort of, that kind of thing. And the plotting of it was really, like, I was really able to easily kind of do an outline.
Right.
And then, you know, you just hope that what you end up with is worth someone's time, you know?
Right.
So I feel like it's getting easier, but what I noticed this time was like it took so much longer than I thought it would. Like I would always give myself like I would have like an hour or two sometimes to work. And I was like, okay, I'm going to finish the rough draft. And like I said, right now where I'm at, I still haven't finished the rough draft. You know, I still haven't finished the ending story. Are you catching the audio?
Yeah.
I tried to, that's fun.
Still working on the first draft. So
someone was getting their face wiped. And
that's all right.
Tragic.
Now I know I've recommended it to you before, but have you read Ondaatje?
You know, he's in the list coming up. Yes.
Okay. Because I think if you
poetry or fiction or both.
It's fiction.
It's fiction. Okay.
Because I think if you throw in some Jhené and Ondaatje's fiction, you'll kind of see that was. That's what my master's thesis was, a structuralist look at Ondaatje's The English Patient. I really wasn't concerned with writing about the meaning of the scenes or the stories or anything like that. I wanted to find out how he got the effects, how he did what he did, and that's. So maybe I'm just projecting onto you what happened to me. So it might not land for you at all.
Well, for me, it was reading again. Ondaatje is, you know, I almost picked up The English Patient, but oddly, I picked up Treasure Island. and I was really blown away by Treasure Island reading it now. I mean, I know I read it when I was a kid, probably like 6 or 7. I was just amazed at being immersed in a story and enjoying it so much. And I was like, that's where it goes back to the old, you know, like magic word, abacadabra, and you know, poets being, you know, they could put images in your mind, you know, being right. like, you know, storytellers, and like they were magical. And I still think they're, you know, they're magical for some of us still. Well, for a lot of us, I mean, Game of Thrones and mm-hmm. any of those, you know, whatever, you know, this golden age of
fantasy
TV, people and, referring to and all of that. Like, it's still that magic. It's like, it's putting us in a world, you know, even Breaking Bad and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But that there's a simplicity to that type of storytelling that is very difficult to achieve.
Oh yeah.
And that was what I noticed reading Treasure Island again, and just, you know, being old and totally in love with this story as it was happening and unfolding. And I was like, I need to, it made me want to try some things without, like I said, the kind of overloaded, like I said, I call them gimmicks, but
right.
it's not quite that, but like, you know, burying the narrative, like mm-hmm. actually telling a story, working those muscles.
Right.
So it was Treasure Island for me recently. And, you know, so that may be my gardener. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, there's definitely, I don't know what I want to say about that. Yeah. Cause that's, to me, that's kind of where I started, is with adventure stories and, you know,
yeah.
very straight, you know, linear thing. And I've kind of, and genre stuff. And a lot of times I think that when I come across to people as being anti-genre and, you know, and even at times, you know, sounding like I'm very against, you know, reading stories that are just, that are fun to read, mm-hmm. is because I've, that to me, that's the given part of everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, to me, Ulysses is a blast.
Right.
I've read it twice and I just laugh most of the time.
Yeah,
I mean, Ulysses. It's hilarious to me. But I've always been more comfortable with that than,
right.
I mean, I guess, you know, starting out reading Stephen King and stuff like that early on, but immediately shifting to, you know, Joyce and Beckett and that kind of stuff.
Right.
Emily Dickinson, like that feels at home for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I want to be able to, tell like a straightforward story
mm-hmm.
as well. Good. You know, I want it to be good, but I also want right. it to be, you know, like, you know.
Right, right.
It's just, that's just been something that's been hard for me to do.
Yeah. No, I haven't done it in so long, and I think that's where I got hung up with the exercise that we were doing this last month, was that I was pushing myself into telling a straight kind of linear, short, mm-hmm. compact narrative, that I was going to flip around and do this this old exercise that I'd basically done as an undergrad, you know, from Ben Nyberg's
POV,
book.
The POV thing.
Right. And
that's probably a valuable exercise, but I totally avoided it because
right.
that seemed hard.
and I wasn't going to, and I avoided it by not doing it, you know? And I should have been a little bit more imaginative about the whole thing and kind of gone off the way you did. But I just was like, I was going to tell this story about, my high school graduation night, you know, because I didn't like my high school. I didn't like very many people that I went to high school with. And so while all of my classmates were going off to project graduation, you know, to lock themselves in the gym at school and spend that, you know, one last full night together, all this other crap
that,
I skipped that whole thing together.
Yeah, I wouldn't have done that.
And instead...
Yeah, I had some really good friends in high school, but I wouldn't have done that. And no. I don't think any of my friends would.
But yeah, so I hung out with a couple of friends of mine who had graduated the year before.
That sounds normal.
Tammy and Jared, and we went out to, this is Wichita in 1990. It was
boom.
Still basically the 80s, and Wichita was still, it still is on the south end of town, particularly kind of rough and, what do you want to call it? Rednecky. And so the thing you did back then was you went to, pool rooms.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And while we were there, there was a shooting in the parking lot. Right. So, and that was what I was going to write about, but nice. I kind of got, like a paragraph and two sentences into it and like,
yeah, I mean, I've lived in Kansas. I was born there. I've lived in, Michigan, Illinois, and then Alabama. I tell people down here all the time, like, rednecks are not restricted to the South. That's
true.
Not a,
true.
It is not just a Southern thing.
Yep.
So I brought all my flannels down from Michigan when I moved down here. And luckily, those became kind of cool.
right.
And now, almost unfortunately, I never liked spending money on haircuts, so I just always grew my hair long, and then it fell out. So right. As it's been falling out, I just shave it, and I was just like, well, I'll just grow a beard because it's whatever. And now also I have problems with distance in terms of sight.
Mm-hmm.
So had to get glasses, but now like beards and glasses and they're cool.
You're here.
I just oddly end up.
You oddly end up being cool by default just because you get older, right? Yeah. Or move. This yeah.
General,
Well, that's nice. You don't have to try to be cool.
I just kind of really what it means is I just kind of blend in, so it's fine.
Right.
I'm okay with that.
So, what are you reading these days? What's on the?
Well, this summer, though, the project is going to be War and Peace.
Oh, wow.
It's going to be the big one. But I've already read, I think I'm on book 10.
And there's still 20 to go.
This was a project started several years ago. And finally, Eric and I are reading Faulkner right now together.
Mm.
And we've read up to Sanctuary, and that's where we decided, like, we could probably get to Sanctuary by the summer, since he teaches as well.
Right.
And then we're going to finish the books that we've started and then finish War and Peace. So War and Peace is the big one this summer, but then I've been kind of halfway kind of rereading Stephen King in order.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like a backseat to like a lot of my other reading.
Right.
And then Richard Chismar, I believe his name is, one of the publishers or editors at Cemetery Dance,
mm-hmm.
this year started doing, it's called Stephen King Revisited, and he's reading everything in chronological order. And I was like, cool. And I was way ahead. And now, he just finished The Dead Zone, and when he reads one, him and a couple of guests will post essays about that particular book. And I had started The Dead Zone probably even like a year ago. And I just haven't finished it yet. I finally rewatched the Cronenberg film. Ooh. I love Cronenberg, but
that one wasn't any good.
It's just not a not a particularly good movie. And you'd think Stephen King and Cronenberg working together, like that sounds great, but
yeah.
Not a very good film. The book, a lot of the folks were saying that it was their favorite, and many people think that it's like one of his best novels. And I think it's okay. It never got to me like The Shining or even really like Carrie, the way Carrie operates and works. But I'm enjoying that. I'm going to finish that up, and then War and Peace will be the next novel. Other than that, I'm reading that Going Clear, that
Right, right. You
book on Scientology, which is wowzers. disturbing.
Right.
Amazingly disturbing.
Cool.
What are you reading?
Well, The Unbearable Lightness of Being right now.
I've it's on the list. How you said you were really enjoying it, right?
Yeah, I feel like I should have read this years ago and shouldn't have been, intimidated by it or putting it off.
Okay, well, like when you say that, because sometimes, like with the Henry Miller, I feel like I would have liked the Henry Miller, or I guess you could call it the Holden Caulfield factor. Like I read Catcher in the Rye, like I was like 22, 23, and I was like, didn't like it, you know?
Right.
I'm going to reread it. I've read it twice, but I'm going to reread it the third time, specifically looking at the writing. Because so many people I respect love that book, and particularly like the writing. And I wasn't focused on the writing. I was just reading the story.
Right.
And Rich Guys Complaining, you know, just doesn't... You know, it doesn't do anything for me. So I never liked the book, but I'm going to reread it and just focus on how it's written.
Right.
So those books, sometimes I'll say, you know, I feel like I should have read these earlier, but that's because I feel like they would have had more of an effect. Is this a book that it would have had more of an effect, or do you think like it's just something you should have read earlier?
Well, it's...
Would you have gained more younger, or do you feel like you're...
That's what I think, because the way that he is writing about romantic relationships, infidelity, mistresses and that type of thing, I feel like that's, you know, one of the pedagogical things about fiction. It's something I could have found some use for, that knowledge, that way of thinking about, you know, romantic relationships that would have been useful in other things I've written. And, you know,
was it different from, say, Updike or like even Woody Allen or something like that in terms of those kind of relationships?
Yeah.
Those are names that come to mind. Like when
I haven't read much Updike. A few things.
Stories? Have you read many of the short stories or
mostly the short fiction?
Okay. I haven't read any of the novels. I've read short stories. He always seems to kind of deal with that.
Yeah, he does. And that's the big thing. That's, you know, kind of what he's known for, that whole, you know, suburban...
Yeah.
...malaise that ends up in infidelity. But it's... From what I understand, it's not really functional infidelity. If there's such a thing. You know what I mean? It's...
The story, but it's a really good story, and it's about like a power outage, and a guy who lives, you know, next door to this beautiful woman, you know, goes over to her house to help her with the alarm or something, and the story may be called Outage. I'm not sure, but
right,
Younger, I really loved A&P. I mean,
right.
I think as a younger reader, and you read that the first time, like maybe that was my Catcher in the Rye, was reading A&P at a young age and, you know, hoping to identify with all that. But I really thought that Updike did a great job in that story of handling those tensions and everything. And it just reminds me of
young sexual tension or infatuation.
Yeah. And you know, the possibility of adultery and it just, what he does in that story is really, really great. It reminded me of the Woody Allen stuff, although the Woody Allen stuff is usually like there are always affairs and everything going on.
Yeah.
So is it, it's different than, I guess it's more of a European
model
of that stuff. So
more of a tolerant European model rather than a neurotic, self-obsessed, you know, New York Jew model, which is Woody Allen. Which that sounds almost vaguely racist on the back of my head, but you know, he does make a big point about
it. But no, it is a kind of, those characters all seem to be kind of self, not just the Woody Allen character in those films, but
right.
the other characters who are having, generally the ones who are having the affairs, not, because a lot of times they're outliers, like they're right. having an affair with a single person. But the ones who are having the affairs often seem to be that kind of self-obsessed, kind of narcissistic, your New England kind of
character. It's an existential kind of angst that I would like to get away from, because I think it can be crippling in a way.
Yeah, yeah, he's kind of gotten away from, I think. I mean, I don't know. I've seen a few of the newer movies. But
right, right. But yeah, I'm also have been reading John Ashbery's collection, Quick Question.
Oh, awesome. Ashbery, yeah.
Yeah. So,
What is it? I assume it's poetry. Poems.
It was just came out. When's the.
Is it a collected poems or is it a.
No, it's a new one. Let me see the publication.
Oh, it's here. Okay. A new collection.
Yeah, it came out in 2012.
Question. How's that going?
Well, it's the first time I've read Ashbery, so there's.
Oh, okay.
You know, although I've heard a lot about him, just because he was. My first impression was that it reminds me a little bit of James Tate, and I love James Tate. So. Oh,
I love James Tate.
So I've really been enjoying it. There's I've been marking quite a few of the poems and. You know, underlining stuff.
I guess that's that New York school, sort of, right? I mean, wouldn't they?
Yeah, I don't know. I'd have to do some, you know, research on him.
Like James Schuyler was part of that group, and
you know, like one of my favorite lines in here is apparently that's how they measure them. Cats in their underwear, as though nothing before had mattered and never will.
He's,
you know,
yeah, he's one. He doesn't edit much. He, you know, he writes. And I mean, it's one thing that's kind of, I think, a part of contemporary poetry that, you know, people are, especially like the names, you know, they put out a book a year, basically. And then you think of someone like Elizabeth Bishop, who published like 100 poems in her lifetime. Right. That's it. There's a lot of, I mean, I'm not just saying with him, but just in general, I always feel like there's a lot more pressure to have like a stuff out there. And I mean, then you get to the point where like, you know, who are you to say like, you know what I mean? Like what people should publish and not. But I mean, that's just part of his compositional. As far as what I know about his compositional, you know, things, he does not edit very much.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's what I figure there's got to be. There's a lot of
that are kind of notoriously difficult too.
Right. And so I've been paying a lot of attention to the way that I emotionally react to the poem rather than trying to decipher, well, what did that mean?
Right. Okay. That's probably a good way to go with that.
What's the tone that really kind of all of that bizarre kind of absurd imagery?
Yeah.
You know, okay. Where does it strike? And then go from there. And then, you know, that's why I'm marking some of the poems, underlining stuff to go back to it and find out, you know, as I change, does that particular line that struck me change?
Yeah.
And where does it take me? Because it also forces me to, this is part of the reason that one of the many reasons that I like to read poetry is that it forces me to reconsider my relationship to language, which I'm sure a lot of the poets that I went to grad school with are probably like going, yay, we won, you know, because as a fiction writer, primarily my interest has always been trying to nail down language.
Yeah,
because it is slippery. And then I think, but The problem with that is you get into that habit and you don't, you start to close doors.
Mm-hmm.
And if you know that that's something that you're prone to doing, closing those linguistic doors, those inventive doors. And this goes back to one of the things I mentioned in our emails before, the decline of personal creativity. If we're
you have to explain
closing those doors, and even though, and you're not acknowledging, you're not leaving room for the slipperiness of language, then it things grind to a halt, which is, I think, has been part of the problem. Of course, I've been, you know, ever since I left Colorado, I've been, it's been, what, 10 years, 10, 11 years now? Been struggling to go, why am I not as you know, productive? Why do I not feel as productive? Why does it, why does my discipline seem to be slipping? And why am I, you know, why do I feel like I'm always coming up with excuses for not writing? Why is it easier to spend the day watching Inside Amy Schumer than writing or reading?
I mean, I had a similar thing working on this, and for the fact that I didn't finish it, and I was trying over the last few days when I finally had everything settled in my mind and like an outline. But it was really like literally trying to find time to like sit and hammer this thing out. It like really came to mind, like, man, why does anyone do this? And then the other thing was like, I can't imagine like ever not doing this.
Right. Right.
Because even, you know, as much as I enjoy, I mean, the only other thing, there are a couple of things, like I'll never make money or anything doing any kind of artwork that I do. I mean, like in terms of like, I mean, artwork in terms of like visual art, initially, that was my first major,
right?
Art music. But, you know, I've come to, you know, I know like where my limits are with that. I thoroughly enjoy it. And there's a, you know, it's the whole, man, what is it, Chickasimele or whatever that guy's name, you know, the whole idea of, was it flow and.
Oh, right. That guy. That, okay.
You know, I'm probably totally butchering his name. I've never known how to say it, but, you know, the one that begins with the C and the Z and the I and the T. but he has that whole idea of, and, there was another guy who put it a different way. They were called zones of, man, I'll have to go look it up. Taz zone, like I'll have to go look it up. Getting into that zone and that flow and that focus, I really feel it when I do the very bad visual art that I generally do.
Mihaly Csikszent, yeah, I see, I got it here. Yeah, he did a TED talk a while back.
Oh, okay, maybe he says his name and I'll finally be able to know how to say it.
Well, I've got the flow, the secret to happiness. Yeah,
it's, yeah, he's,
what makes life worth living, noting that money cannot make us happy. He looks to those who find pleasure and lasting satisfaction in activities that bring about a state of flow.
His theory of that and the idea of that, I mean,
added it to the show notes.
Oh, wow. Anyway, sorry. I just got a weird email. I was going to look at something else. I was trying to find the Taz stuff. It's something I can talk to you about after this. Hakim Bey, which is really a temporary autonomous zone, ontological anarchy. Some of these articles are available in the Hermetic Library, but the same guy who wrote those, I never look at him on a school computer because he is also the Man Boy Love Association. He also wrote a lot of that stuff. So I'm always kind of wary, like on the computer, I look up his, but his writings on, to me, on anarchy and chaos and
there's nothing
this
more.
Stuff are really great. So Taz, the temporary autonomous zone, in this like zone of creativity, like that stuff to me is really, really interesting. And it goes with that other guy's idea of flow. I feel that very strongly when I'm playing music, when I'm making really bad visual art, when I'm planning or researching, and sometimes in the writing, you know, of something.
Right.
But yeah, the, you know, the payoff for this stuff, that was what I was thinking of, was just like, you know, like you were saying, like, you know, why don't I just go binge watch a bunch of this other stuff? I was like, this is, you know, on one level.
Right.
You know, you don't want to call it like difficult or hard, because, you know, I've had hard jobs. I have a hard job now, and it's a very different thing from that. But at the same time, you know, writing something good is hard. And
true.
And that was the thing. I was like, I'm going to have to, you know, like the decision, you know, that I made now is like, I may never see any paybacks from any of this, but I'm going to do it anyway.
Right. You know? Right.
It's just too much not to do, you know?
Right.
It's too much not to keep doing it.
I attribute my my binge watching and not reading to avoidance. There's something I'm avoiding, and I haven't quite been able to figure out what it is.
Well, for me, part of it was like, I've already made the story in my head, and, you know, I've heard filmmakers complain about that kind of thing. But the other part of that is, man, it's, and you know, for me, I'm specifically talking about writing that kind of linear narrative. Like it's hard. It's hard to me. I think it's a difficult thing, you know. It's work. In the first one, you know, you got to go back and I mean, people, not everyone does. I mean, there are people making money. I listen to enough other podcasts and interested in enough other genres where, you know, people are cranking out books in a month and, you know, sometimes less.
Right.
And.
Well, they're definitely not concerned about structuralism.
Yeah, no. And, so.
They're taking the structure as a given, as a preordained kind of established thing.
You know, not making the sentences what the sentences could be. You know, even if it's a genre work, you know, there's room for poetry and
true. That is correct.
For, you know, like a kind of a magic to it.
And when they make room for that, that's when it's good.
You get good stuff. Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's when you throw off the attention to language, to poetry, to even in a way, the beauty of perception or warped perception, and you just say, we're going from point A to point B, put in the right, when you get into that formula thing, it loses something. It loses that human texture.
Bradbury did a lot of that stuff really well.
And, yeah.
And Eric, I talked to Eric a little bit a couple days ago. And one of the things that we did teaching 10th grade together was we brought in Fahrenheit 451 to the, and it was before Hunger Games and a lot of the whole YA dystopia thing
right.
really got huge. And it did well. It always did well because he basically predicts, you know, walls, like Facebook friend walls. He, mm-hmm. you know,
giant flat screen TVs.
Yeah, absolutely. he calls them shells, but they're basically like iPod. They're basically mm-hmm. like an iPod and the little,
right.
you know, headphones and all that. And man, yeah, he said like this year he had like a really strong reaction to that book. Overall, it was like the it was the book that his students still responded to the most.
Mm-hmm.
And if you teach the book enough, you also see, you know, I mean, Bradbury loved poetry and that kind of stuff. And there's the whole first part of the book too, when Montag is kind of walking in the street. One of the interesting things is there's little stuff like where he's walking through and he's walking through all these leaves of orange and red.
Uh-huh.
He's walking through, you know, flames, you know, it's like, it's, you know,
right.
Bradbury's doing all these like more subtle things that the students don't get initially when they read it. But when you bring them into that, like they're right. able to see, you know, 10th grade is really where they're, you know, it's why so many times you read Lord of the Flies in 10th grade, because they're like, oh, the seashell means democracy. The piggy's glasses mean that he's, you know, flawed in some way and they get cracked. And it means that it's the kind of, you know, fall of the kids, and then eventually leads to Piggy's fall. And, mm-hmm. and that's, I guess, spoilers. I don't know.
I think of all the people either on this podcast or listening to it, I might be the only one that hasn't read Lord of the Flies.
it's really good.
Although when I see it regurgitated in other media, I recognize it immediately.
I literally read that book 10 or 15 times before I saw some of the structural stuff that we're talking about and some of the more subtle ways he builds that book. It was one of those reading that book maybe the 10th or 15th time teaching it, because I would reread it every year that I taught it. It was one of those, you know, Dickinson top of your head blown off moments. I was like, oh my God, like right. he's in, you know, almost like this image wise, he's like embedded this kind of spiral of images mm-hmm. that revolve around each other. And it's so easy to kind of like, I had casted that book off, you know, when I was in college, when I was doing my more important reading, you know, it's like a kid's book or whatever, you know?
Right.
You know, it was a good book. Yeah. I liked it in sixth grade or whatever, but, you know, I'm reading grown-up stuff now. But it was only after, and that was a thing. And that was a thing that like, that was one of the books where I was like, I've read this thing, you know, this may be my 15th time reading this book, and I'm just now seeing
right.
like, how dense am I? Like, how dense am I in my other, you know what I mean? Like, how dense am I in my other reading and stuff? And that this book that I was more than willing to toss off as a children's book has this kind of imagistic structure.
Right. Right.
Spiraling in it to make this, you know, I was like, man, yeah, it really was humbling.
Yeah.
It was, you know, and that's the thing, is that is a book too. That's a straight like linear narrative book, you know, just
right.
read the book, get into the adventure of it. But it really holds up to multiple readings and cool. really intense kind of deconstruction, if you want to say that. Surprisingly. I mean, yeah.
So do you have an idea for an exercise, or do you want to skip exercises for this round? Or do we have some other project that we want to lay on ourselves before the next?
I'm willing to try whatever. Yeah.
because I really don't have an idea. My last one apparently was a total bomb.
I mean, I can pull something off a shelf. I don't have ideas myself, but we can pull something from a book or.
Sure. Let's see what we've got. Do you need a moment? We can pause the recording and pick something up.
Let me grab a couple books and then we'll read a couple of these things out and see. Yeah, I'm willing to try whatever.
Right, and I have to go visit the bathroom, so.
Oh, okay, cool. I'm 19 at this exercise that I was looking through these various books to find. It's a book by Josip Novakovic. And here's the exercise. I had said that it was a Henry James exercise, but it's one that he kind of, I guess, mentioned about another writer. But anyway, so this is a one-page exercise. It says, according to Henry James, a writer wrote a novel from a glimpse of a seminary student's dinner party. Write a scene of a story from a glimpse you have had of a group of people in a cafe, zoo, train, or anywhere. Sketch the characters in their setting and let them interact. Do you find that you know too little? Can you make up enough or import from other experiences to fill the empty canvas? So then it has a little objective here. Objective, to find out if you can make much out of little. If you can, great. If you can't now, don't worry, you might later, or you'll have to get your stories from other materials. Check. Can you visualize these people further? Can you begin to hear at least one person speak? If not, go back and find a way of talking that might fit one of the people in the group and carry on from there.
Okay.
How do you, like with the whole dialogue thing, how do you, as much problem as I've had with like writing a linear narrative, I would say I've never had a problem not hearing characters, or at least I felt like it's not a problem.
Right.
How about you? I mean, I used to take notes of conversations in restaurants. I think part of it comes from doing a lot of interviews.
Mm-hmm.
Interviews for newspapers and things, but then I used to write down people's conversations around me in restaurants and coffee shops and stuff.
Yeah, dialogue, the response has always been a little uneven. Some people have said that everybody I write sounds the same, and other people have had a different reaction to it, that I'm better at dialogue than I am at other things. And so I don't know. It's one of those things that I feel like I always struggle with. That and trying to avoid kind of the straight, you know, minimalist declarative sentence, which is fine. It works great. If you can master that, that's fantastic. Mm. But I tend to like a little bit more meat on a sentence than what, you know, I tend to get from, you know, minimalism.
Like I said, besides the
dialogue, my favorite exercise, one of the favorite things we always did in graduate school was in one of my workshops was we had a weekly exercise. We had to drag a tape recorder out and secretly record conversations around us and transcribe them. You know,
I've been doing that since high school, but I would just put them in notebooks. Yeah.
And, you know, because that would help you get a feel for, you know, different people's pacing and word choice.
Now with the way people will talk on a phone around you, it's hilarious. Like just hearing that one side of the conversation, like it's so funny.
Right.
And
I, most of my revision tends to, when I revise, well, once I get the story down, a lot of my revision revolves on the language and trying to avoid having my characters say obvious and exact things and rather have them obfuscate and actually do what people do when they're having difficult conversations with someone else about emotional things, which is, you know, sidestep and evade and and hedge their bets and all that stuff. That's something I was
Hills like by the elephants. Yeah.
Yeah. And maybe that's part of the reason sometimes that people say everybody sounds the same is because I'm not, you know, with trying to create my characters and their own particular verbal tics for avoiding, you know, saying what they really mean. I've got one trick of doing it myself. And if I actually understood how other people did it better, then I would understand people who are avoiding stuff in real life. And so there's that struggle. All of my characters tend to avoid difficult things the same way, I guess. Linguistically, you know.
Talking about characters speaking the same way, have you ever read the Foundation trilogy by Asimov?
No, huh?
Have you read the Martian Chronicles?
Nope.
Okay. I'm not really a big sci-fi reader, but I love Philip K. Dick, and I mean Lovecraft is kind of on that border. Stanislaw Lem I like a lot, but I've been over the years trying to read like the, you know, the canonical, you know, Stranger in a Strange Land. And,
I was never able to finish that one. I got halfway through it.
It was okay. What's interesting now is that I need to go back and reread it because some of the character and some of what's going on there is based on Heinlein's relationship with L. Ron Hubbard.
Oh, wow.
So I don't know if you read far enough in the book to get to the whole cult thing, but that's like the birth of...
It was like in high school.
He was there, like L. Ron Hubbard had an affair with Heinlein's wife. And it was
that makes sense.
Birth of Scientology and all that. So,
so what you're saying is Scientology was born out of Hubbard's need to emotionally justify his destruction of a marriage.
And it gets so bizarre and strange. Like it's stranger than I've watched a lot of documentaries about, like the, you know, the years that he spent on the boat, like where he just the boats, and he was going around basically trying to avoid taxes and lawsuits.
Right.
He
spent a number of years in Wichita, actually. Hubbard did.
Oh wow.
Yeah, and there was a pretty big legal battle between Hubbard and some people in Wichita.
I don't doubt that. Everywhere he went, there were big lawsuits, and that's what he was trying to hide from. In fact, you know, according to this book, he let, you know, one of his wives go to jail, go to federal prison for it.
Yeah. He was a nice guy, wasn't he?
Oh, man. It's insane. It's incredible. But, reading those stuff, as far as like characters all sounding the same, one of the books, like in the Foundation trilogy, where Asimov gives like the, you know, the rules for androids and like the three rules for robots or whatever. And also, those books. The plotting, the way it works is it's more of, and that's why I asked if you had read the Martian Chronicles, because it works this way too. It's more like episodes or scenes, and it's not like a straight through story. It's like you'll turn the page and like literally centuries have gone by and you're in the same place, but with totally new characters.
Right.
And you have like a galactic, I mean, Lucas obviously read the Foundation trilogy because you have a galactic empire, you have parsecs, there's a lot of jargon that went into Star Wars that is in the Foundation trilogy. But every person in the Foundation trilogy speaks like and acts like Han Solo. It's like Asimov had this idea of, you know, a badass, and like that badass was like eventually was Han Solo. So the irritating thing about that book is like you're moving centuries and centuries into this history of, you know, these planets and these places and these civilizations right. come and go throughout the story. But like your main heroes, they all sound like Han Solo. Every one of them. And it's so irritating. And there's one that's a woman, but she's still like, it's like, wow, she sounds like Han Solo. that's one of the, you know, group of books or books where I really noticed characters that sounded the same. You know?
Right, right. Okay. So you're gonna type up that that exercise and shoot that over to me.
Yeah, I'll type it up okay. just straight out of the book and give, you know, I'll send the information about the book, whatever.
Okay. Cool. When I get that, I'll put together the post and get the episode up.
Yeah, I'll put up the list. I've got the list written out for the second episode. All the references. I went right. back and, you know, listened to those and cataloged it. It's just kind of fun for me to kind of follow the train of ideas.
Right.
I don't know who's read it or whatever, but
no, I think I will.
Did you go back and look at the first one that I did? Like
yeah.
the first episode? It's kind of interesting to kind of follow the flow of, you know, ideas and references, at least for me.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's interesting. I may have linked to it at some point on somewhere, but.
Oh, okay.
I'll make sure that we get, you know, when we. Because we're kind of up against the deadline here. Tomorrow we have to have a new episode up. I've been slacking off
Is this one going up tomorrow?
Yeah.
Like, oh wow, yeah. Okay.
We're close. First Monday of the month is the way that the laboratory works. But
yeah, you know. I totally missed my own blog stuff. I didn't respond to your blog this.
Saturday the 6th is actually the first Saturday, so. We haven't posted one for June okay. yet. But yeah, no, I mean, I missed the shop talk with Gavin because that was over the holiday weekend and schedules didn't work out right.
Oh, okay.
I've got a couple of people that I'm trying to line up interviews with, but haven't awesome. Worked out. So, you know, we've missed a couple of episodes. So I'm looking into doing some other things to make sure that I have, something in the barrel to go out if I miss a regular episode. Plus, I'm wondering if there's.
You got oddly quiet for a few weeks.
Yeah, yeah.
Like
yeah.
there were no podcasts, there were no blogs, there was
yep.
not much. So I got kind of worried.
Well, yeah, I'm trying funny. To.
Maybe he's retired. I don't know.
No, trying to realign everything because I guess this is one of the topics we had, and so we've been at it for an hour and a half already, so we might want to wrap it up here.
Someone, yeah, people maybe.
But know, maybe no, I've been trying to think of ways. Well, one, I've these two people that I'm trying to set up interviews with. They're kind of the last two people that I have, you know, direct access to.
Oh, okay.
You know, as people I know and so, have am in yeah. contact with that I can get on there. After these two, then it's pretty much me trying to get strangers.
Oh wow!
Writers that I whose books I like, but I've never met before.
That sounds good. That sounds like a good.
Yeah, but that takes longer, and so the turnaround yes. time is going to be more difficult. So I'm looking at ways to fill time and
put out
episodes.
Apple, but I can.
Well, we've got this one here, and hopefully we'll get onto some kind of schedule with Gavin. But if we don't, then it's just you and me, and. You know, so I'm looking at, you know, doing just a monologue type of thing. I've got some essays that I've been thinking about, you know, breaking up and doing like little chunks.
Even some of your old posts and everything, like that was always, like I said, I mean, I think I said whenever I was on the regular show, I always liked your blog because like you actually wrote about things. Like I was like, oh wow, he read stuff. And
yeah, so I might do that with the
like wrote this like really, you know, interesting essay. So I always admired that aspect of your blog.
So I might try doing something like that with the podcast.
Well, you seem to have, you know, that phrase, you know, a finger on the pulse, but like you seem to be, you know, seems like you keep up with either stuff that's going on technology wise with writing, but you seem to always be like right, you know. Well, you seem to know like,
so,
where but... the arguments are having. Like you seem to like know what those arguments are. And
too bad I can't parlay that into a job where I don't have to work for somebody else. Take that back. A job where I would be working for someone that I actually get along with.
Yeah. Or just, you know, being able to, and talk about these things. I mean, I guess like, I mean, what is it, Gallicat? I mean,
maybe, yeah.
I don't know.
Well, you know,
maybe one of those, but I mean, you always seem to be like, know what's going on at multiple levels, not just like, you know, oh, hey, the new Jonathan Franzen book's out or whatever, but like,
right. Oh, well, thank you.
What's happening with the, you know,
I'm doing a good job of fooling somebody.
Fool me.
I've always been afraid that I'm always afraid that I'm naive and out of the touch and out of the loop and
oh wow,
you know,
well, maybe that comes from because we don't live, you know, on the coast, like, you know,
yeah,
New York, LA. I mean, maybe we'll probably always feel that way to some extent.
Well, this arises specifically for me out of two incidents. Well, there's a whole plethora of other things not related to literature that take this same model. But there were two moments dealing specifically with literature that, you know, that
does it have anything to do with you beating somebody with like big stuff?
No. It doesn't have anything to do with me screaming, "Have you studied the history?" You know, it doesn't have anything to do with that. As an undergrad, I was writing some short story, and I got Harper Lee and To Kill a Mockingbird confused and mixed up with Ken Kesey and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. I got the two of them screwed up.
That is awesome.
Right?
That would make a great book.
And I made this huge mistake in front of my first or second creative writing workshop. So, and then all these literary kids there and Steve Heller, who, right.
What was the context though? Like, what did you say?
I had put it in the story.
Different that...
I was writing a story about a writer who had gotten published and was struggling to get his second book published, kind of where I'm at right now. And I'd made some reference to a writer that had published one book and then disappeared, which would be Harper Lee.
Right.
But in the story, it was Ken Kesey and One Flew Over a Cuckoo's Nest. And my instructor very politely said, no, Ken Kesey has several books. I think you're thinking of, right. And this happened in front of the whole class, this massive amount of humiliation, which totally arises out of the fact that when, you know, growing up, being taught literature badly and being growing up in Dodge City, you know, and although my parents were readers, you know, they weren't pushing books on me. My mom's big collection of books were all romance novels, historical romance novels. My dad's stuff was all books about World War II.
Which is probably why I write
about love and violence all the time. But
my mom had like Cleopatra and
right.
the Thornbirds and stuff like that.
Right. And then after I'd finished my BA in creative writing, I made some stupid comment at work one day at a bookstore.
Oh.
About, oh, fuck. I can't think of her name right now. Sylvia Plath. I made some weird comment about Sylvia Plath and the biography of her father. I guess she had some poem that she wrote comparing her father to a Nazi officer.
It's daddy. Right. Yeah, daddy. Like, right. That's one that friends of mine and I have talked about, like, where, you know, maybe your personal stuff wasn't necessarily as bad as the Holocaust.
Right, right.
I do like Sylvia Plath.
But I had made some comment about, you know, Sylvia Plath's father actually being a Nazi officer. And realized, you know, quite quickly that that was a mistake. And those...
Why was it a mistake, though? Like,
because it was actual biography and not illusion, not comparison, not metaphor. It was actual biography. Right.
To that extent, I would say unearned metaphor to a large extent. You know?
Right.
But, right.
So...
Otto. Kind of, wasn't his name Otto?
Yeah, I don't know. What the fuck? But, you know, I had made some comment about it being actual biography and not, you know, metaphor. And...
Yeah. I'll tell you the funniest story.
And so realizing those two mistakes kind of has always put me in this position where it's like, I am not going to open my fucking mouth and make a comment about something until I've thought about it. Right? So if I have any
mistake that bad, but I mean that's probably a good philosophy anyway.
Right, but the mistakes or not anything that leads to personal humiliation is worse than anything else on the planet. I mean, you cut off my finger, fine. At least I wasn't humiliated in the process. You know, if I cut it off myself because I'm doing something obscene, that's humiliation. But you know. Just don't humiliate me. I should not humiliate myself, which happens a lot more than I want to admit.
Well, I've been there. Yeah.
So yeah.
As far as those kind of stories, like one of my favorites, it was in grad school, and well, I wasn't in grad school. I was actually an undergrad, and I was taking the grad school classes, and there was a guy who had to have been in his 60s. And we were reading the narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only kind of like novella of Poe. And it's very, and at the end, you know, you have like a whole weird land that he comes to that's basically kind of like At the Mountains of Madness,
mm-hmm.
by H.P. Lovecraft at the end. Yeah, one of them has giant penguins and just weird stuff like that. But, so there's a 60-year-old guy, and there were like three of us in the room, and they were master students, and I was an undergrad, and I knew the professor, and he had allowed me to take the class because we were reading Moby Dick. I took the class specifically. It was 19th century American. I mentioned already, like that was kind of an era that I really liked. And we were going to read Moby Dick in the class, so I was like, man, I've got to take that class, and he let me take it. The guy, he sits down and he goes, man, this Poe guy, he's really good. You kind of look at him like, wow, yeah he is. And he's like, what other novels did he write? Kind of looking at him like, well, I mean, the whole purpose of us reading this is like, this is really his only almost novel kind of thing,
right?
Oh, wow, yeah, well, I mean, what else did he do? Like, the Raven? Like, I mean, there's a football team named after the Raven. Like,
right.
It's Poe. It's Edgar Allan Poe. Like, you're a master's student in English.
And you'd never heard of Poe.
60 years old, and you're clueless about who Edgar Allan Poe is. It was one of the most bizarre moments
in,
you know, a seminar class that I've ever had. This Poe guy, he's pretty good. The understanding is...
Okay, that makes me feel a little bit better.
He is pretty good. He invented, you know...
The detective story?
Basically invented, you know, mystery fiction. Invented the rules for short stories at one point. Created, you know... you know, is one of the major horror writers. Wow. You know, it was so surreal. So yeah, I wouldn't feel bad about the details on that stuff.
All right. I'll take your word for it. Okay. So you'll send me the exercise.
Yeah.
Let's go ahead and sign off for our listeners, because sure. They're going to have about an hour and 50 minutes worth of us here. So be back next month. It'll probably take you that long to listen to us to this time.
It may indeed.
Thanks, Stephen. Don't go away.
Thank you. Yeah.
All right, so there you have it, the laboratory number 3 with my friend Steven. So yeah, keep an eye on the feed. We're gonna be coming out with stuff kind of erratically for a while I get my shit together, line up some new things, because you know, life changes. I'm getting bored. It's, you know, whatever. Send me a message, because I haven't heard from anybody. I'd like to hear what you're thinking, even if you hate me. So shoot me a note. Tell me I suck. I don't care. I'd like to hear from anybody who's listening, because I haven't really heard from anybody who's listening. Write me a message. You know, go visit the website. Do it. Yeah.